Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John Pilger. John is an award-winning journalist, an author, a documentary filmmaker. He's also been a foreign and war correspondent. He's a longtime critic of Western imperialism. He believes a journalist's job, in his words, first of all, is to look in the mirror of his own society and report on it accurately. Don't get much of that, John, by the major media in Britain, certainly in other Western countries, and most of all in America. John, it's great to have you back on.
Very good to be back, Steve.
So much going on always. I always like to address the topics most on the mind of my guests. I've written a good bit about the shutdown that ended on Thursday. Maybe you've addressed that as well. Certainly a lot of talk about it around the world, and there should be a lot of talk.
Well, I think most people view it in a bemused way, really. The United States has become a rather exotic spectacle, and I don't mean that in a particularly attractive way. It's quite clear this was forced by the extreme right of the Republican Party, or I suppose you could call them the lunar right of the Republican Party, as various degrees of extreme right across the spectrum. But just to guess, it seemed to me what was happening was an attempt, and I think this applies not merely to the Tea Party element here, but to the right in political America. I think there is the beginning of an attempt to privatize as much of the government as possible. That's almost absurd because, the United States is not a free market society. None of the major corporations would really exist without government patronage. So the state is part of their own wealth and their power. However, there is an ideological force at work here, and that it's almost self-destructive, and I think that would like to privatize as much of the government as possible. That's true to a lesser degree here in Britain, where one of the world's most efficient postal services is being privatized for no reason whatsoever. It actually makes a profit. It's strictly ideological. So this is the main political thrust across the United States, in Britain, and in Europe and other countries, that so-called market forces, and that's a euphemism, of course, or whatever you want to call them, are really rampant these days.
Well, I certainly agree, John, and I think the rage to privatize here absolutely is what's going on. I had an interview earlier this morning talking about the shutdown, the budget debate, the debt ceiling debate, and I was asked, what effect did this have on ordinary people during this period? And my comment was that 16 days of shutdown for most people, the great majority, not everybody, but the great majority, was little more than an inconvenience. Most of those people who didn't get paid over that period will get paid now that they're back at work. Their pay will remain in effect. It simply will be delayed in paying it, but it will be paid and they will get it. So, again, I stress the inconvenience. The real issue is what will happen going forward, and that's where the real crisis for ordinary people will begin, where they will really suffer. The privatization is one thing, including the erroneously called entitlements in America, named the big ones, namely Medicare and Social Security. They most certainly are not entitlements. I need to explain to people who don't understand that these are contractual federal obligations, no different than when an individual buys a private insurance policy and pays premiums. Payroll deductions in America our insurance premiums for a government promise to me and everybody else. I'm retired. I'm on Medicare and Social Security. But to every working person in America who's on these programs and has a deduction, the government promises when they retire or when they're eligible, disability is one eligibility factor that can kick it in earlier. People can retire at 62, not for very much longer, 65. The age will ratchet up incrementally. Probably they'll have it up to 70 before too long. Well, people need to work anyway because they simply don't have enough money to get by if they don't. But again, the government wants to welsh on these, hand them over to Wall Street profiteers, and let them rip off as much profit as possible and have ordinary people suffer. That's one of the great tragedies coming on the other end of this. And unfortunately, John, I'm afraid Obama, most Democrats and Republicans go along with this, and they agreed on this long before this crisis happened.
Well, then the ordinary people you describe will have to do something about it, won't they? I mean, how long will people go on agreeing, in effect, to be victims?
It's a question I ask myself all the time, John.
Here. I mean, we can go on forever wringing our hands about how bad they are and how unjust it is, but the question hangs over this, and it's not an easy question to answer, and that is, what are people going to do about it? And that applies to people all over the world, but if you're talking about the United States, a great many people in the United States have the privilege of access to information and mobility and certain services and that many people in the world don't have. What they do with this privilege is really up to them. And I think this is an absolutely central question now, because the media is full of the iniquities of those who try to rule over us and control our lives. But the question is, what are you going to do about it? That's the question.
Well, again, I absolutely agree, John, and I think we both very strongly believe in whatever we do, it should be nonviolent. But if people just sit back and dismissively let this go on, they'll find that as bad as things are now for them, they'll get progressively worse ahead, and I've seen that. And we're both of an age where we can look back at a time when things were so much different than they are now. I think of my own country. Things were far from perfect when I was growing up, mostly in the 40s and the 50s. But it was paradise then compared to the way things are today. And as we move ahead progressively, things just keep going downhill further and further. And ordinary people are so gravely affected, so greatly harmed. Real unemployment, John, in America isn't the 7.2% or so that's the headline figure when the numbers come out. It's over 23%. Over 23% based on the way the figure was calculated before it began to be manipulated and corrupted. So the headline figure, which is called U3 here, is basically a meaningless number. And even people who are working, most of them are way underemployed. They have part-time or temp jobs. They don't earn enough. They don't get benefits enough. They really suffer. And whatever they have now, they'll get less ahead unless they do something. And it's up to ordinary people to act in their own defense, or heaven help what they'll face in the future, let alone their children.
Yeah, okay. Well, we come back to the question, Steve. What are we going to do about it? We know that. I'm not sure about the paradise in the past. And I think we, those of us who've lived through a number of interesting times, can say, turn back and pull out the old one of the good old days. I'm not sure about that. In many ways, they were good days because people were reacting and doing something about their lives. Each age has its own difficulties. But the question is unchanged with every generation. Are you going to take control of your own life or not? And of course, like the chorus then rises, well, I've got all these problems. And some people have problems that just can't simply be solved. And they can't really change their lives overnight. That's very, very clear. But there are many others who can. And until a society decides to collectively stand up for itself, these injustices will continue. And you'll be saying the same things on your program, Steve, and I'll be saying the same things, writing the same things over and over again. And I must have to say, when I write about them, it feels just repetitive over and over. So the question, you cannot avoid that question. It is, people, I've got to start to think about a way of coming together to stop this. And I wouldn't actually, non-violent, of course, but, don't put up all the conditions first. There has to be a resistance first. There has to be a resistance to all of this. Otherwise, history stops. Because history is about change and the change wrought by great power and the resistance to that great power by ordinary people acting together. Otherwise there is a very bleak future for the next generation, and I think we have a responsibility to the next generation.
John, in America alone, there's some pretty important figures in U.S. history who believed in civil disobedience, Henry David Thoreau being one, but he certainly wasn't the only one. And I absolutely believe in civil disobedience or disruptive protests. And it gets results, John, here. I mean, the civil rights protests that went on for years, this stuff just doesn't change, doesn't happen quickly. It could take many years to get change. Civil rights actions began... Well, I remember them from the 1950s. I'm not certain what happened before that, but from the 1950s, it wasn't until the mid-1960s that really there were any results, and unfortunately they're all lost now. But it shows that people power really can work. Same thing with the labor movement in America. It took many years to get labor reform, and it came in the middle of the Great Depression, the Wagner Act under Franklin Roosevelt, where labor for the first time could bargain at least to some degree on a level playing field. Deal with management. That's all gone now. Labor is a shadow of what it was after the Wagner Act and in the 40s and the 50s. And it's really in dismal shape now, plus civil rights. I remember quoting, I don't remember the person's name, but I remember quoting a civil rights leader a few years ago saying that all the civil rights gains won in the 1960s are lost now. They're all lost. Things are as bad or worse than they were then. And it's true. And there's no Martin Luther King around today as a great public figure to lead people, John. We certainly need somebody. I think leadership is very important. We had the Occupy Wall Street movement here that is very quiet these days. It's not gone, but it's very quiet. I certainly hope it comes back, maybe in new form. I think it's trying to recreate itself. But we need those kind of movements and lots of others, and they need to stay the course because you don't win these fights very easily. Again, I mean, you could spend a decade fighting these battles.
Well, yeah, but you've got to learn from movements. The Occupy movement, I think its main benefit was that it encouraged people and it made them feel good. But where did it go? It went nowhere. And that's a fact. What has happened is that people... Still, so many good people who want to change things, who want to resist, part of them are still attached to the Democratic Party. So many of them were effectively conned, deluded by the election of Barack Obama. I've always felt that until we face the reality that, yes, there are extremes, that the, basically in the spectrum there are differences, of course there are, but that the power structure in the United States and in other Western democracies has solidified. It's a monolith with a couple of slightly varying wings to it. Barack Obama's greatest achievement was to kill the anti-war movement, because the anti-war movement and all those groups, big groups associated with the Democratic Party, simply shut up shop when he was elected. Now, some of it has come back, there's no doubt about that, but not much. These are new times. We can't recall the great labor struggles. We can't recall Roosevelt. We can't do all of that because these are different times. One of the differences in the times today that is very positive is that people have, in my opinion, a greater awareness, a greater consciousness of what is happening around them in their own country and elsewhere in the world than they've had ever before. And that includes the 1960s. There was more action in the late 1960s and 70s. But I think there's more awareness now. Now, it's what people do with that awareness that really matters. And at the moment, there are spectacular expressions of resistance around the world. Greece, Spain, Italy, U.S., South Africa, but they're more expressions of anger rather than strategized expressions designed to bring change. I think we're going through a period of the transfer of power from what used to be known as liberal social democracies to corporatisms. The corporatisms are not democracies. They don't have real participation. This is true in the United States, it's true in Britain and in the European Union. And that has to be analyzed and understood, because that's very different from the power that people in the 1960s faced. It's not as obvious, although the effects of it are very obvious, and you've described them. So that to me has to be the next stage in just understanding the nature of this imposition of impoverishment on so many people, and to do something about it.
And we sure better do something, John, or heaven help as I look forward, I see coming. I literally feel most concerned and sorry for young people in America and across Europe. You need to go to other parts of the world to, in some ways, for some people, have a glimmer of hope where economies are growing and there are more opportunities being created than being lost. So things certainly are far from rosy in many of these places. And there's great poverty and great human problems. But at least things are moving in an upward direction. In America and across Europe, they seem to be moving in the opposite direction. Unemployment too high, poverty too high, opportunity too low. It just goes on and on. When I think back, John, to the days when I grew up, there were lots of opportunities. Even in soft economies, I had no trouble finding a decent job when I got out of school. Oh, I had a couple of good degrees, but the same degrees today, I might have a terrible time finding a job. But I had no trouble at all back in 1960 mm-hmm. when I graduated and entered the workforce for the first time. And it's a whole new situation today. You can have a graduate degree. You can have a Ph.D. Unless you have a skill in a high-demand area, you can be in very serious trouble. And, we could go on and on with that. But it's a dismal situation facing so many people. And people need to react and do something to change it, because it won't happen any other way. I remember writing about Obama, John, during the 2008 campaign. He was a great deceiver. James Petras calls him a con man, and he absolutely is a con man. But if you looked at his voting record in the Senate and his record back in Illinois politics, you would see that he was anything but a progressive. He was far from that. He was as conservative as most Republicans. And all you have to do is go back. His voting record is right there. Anybody can access it. You can see what he voted on, bill by bill. And you can see that literally he was as Republican as most Republicans straight down the line. And he sure proved it as president, but his rhetoric goes one way, his policies go another way, and still around half the country is still bamboozled by him. It shows that people don't
pay attention. That's nothing new, Steve. Rhetoric goes one way and policies go the other. I mean, that's as old as politics. I think it's not enough for people to say they've just been conned. Yes, he was a con man. He is a con man. No question about that. But why were people conned? And why did they allow themselves to be conned? That's not such an easy question to answer. It's quite a difficult one for many people. I understand the tremendous support that Obama received from the African-American community. It must have been quite difficult to believe that this was happening. There was an African-American president in the land of slavery. The symbolism of that was extraordinary. So you can understand that. But that is so superficial, because Obama's historic significance ended with that fact. That was it. Yes, unusual. First, extraordinary, but nothing after that, because Obama was simply a member of a class that had arisen, a privileged class, which included a number of African Americans, but really didn't apply to race at all. Obama was serving the class of power in the same way that other African Americans, for instance, George W. Bush's cabinet was probably the most multiracial in U.S. history, I think, with Condoleezza Rice, a fanatic, Colin Powell, the man who helped to start the invasion of Iraq, and the Attorney General, and many others. So that question of race, which is a big open wound in the United States, confused matters with the election of Obama. That he wasn't seen for what he was seen as a symbol. So separating those two issues became very, very important. However, many, many other people would have understood that that class of that Obama represented had been serving great power and unaccountable power in the United States for a very long time, and he was just another one. And he has turned out to be as extreme as George W. Bush. I mean, that's the pattern of U.S. presidents since the Second World War, I think, that one ups the ante on his predecessor. One becomes, takes on the political baggage of his predecessor. Clinton was a good example of that. Clinton was an extremely right-wing president, though often portrayed as liberal. But Clinton had taken on Reagan's clothes. And so it went on. George W. Bush certainly represented a new cabal, but I don't think it was altogether that different from the power groups that had ruled the U.S. before. And Barack Obama took on the clothes of the Bush administration and took them further. Right from minute one, his appointments were all from the criminal side of Wall Street. He was the first president ever to bring over the entire U.S. Defense Department bureaucracy of his predecessor, including the Secretary of Defense. And he's instigated much violence around the world. He now runs probably the most comprehensive terrorist network we've ever seen. You can still run into people over here, let alone over there, who say, oh, what do you think went wrong with Barack Obama? As if Jesus Christ had arrived in 2008. Just absurd. And I think people are aware of that, but we now can't afford to be conned anymore. It's out there. There's plenty of information. Programs like yours, Steve, but there's the whole internet, and there's still that part of it that's not run by the NSA. There's a lot of information to give those who still don't quite understand what's happening to their lives and who's doing it to them. And that still comes back to the question that in the end, it is going to be up to people to do something about it. One encouragement is when you consider the amount of energy and money that unaccountable power expends in expressing its fear of people. I saw the Associated Press did a study on the over 4 or 5 years, they found the Pentagon had spent something like $4.5 billion, basically, on propaganda. And that propaganda was not aimed at the Taliban. It was aimed at the American people. So why are they so frightened of them? Great unaccountable power is always frightened of the people. That's why they spy on them. That's why they... And why are they frightened of them? It's so old. You can go back to the French Revolution and beyond. Why are they frightened of them? Because they think they might change a system. They feel they always respect, interestingly, the power of people to change a system, even if the people themselves don't see themselves as having that power.
John, we're just about out of time. I've got to interrupt you. The one hope I have is that a good sign, the ratings for the major media news programs, television in America, are going down, and the ratings for programs like Progressive Radio and other online services are going up, which means more and more people are finding out the truth they need to know, and this is what gives me great hope. John, it was really a great joy for me to have you on. You're a heroic figure in my mind. You've taught me a great deal with your books. I've read every single one of them. They're on my shelf. I hope maybe you'll write another. You're so busy doing documentaries, you don't have a chance to write books. I hope maybe there'll be another one at some point.
There'll be another one, I'm sure.
Thank you, John.
Okay, Steve. All the best to you.
Thank you. I'll just remind my listeners, tune in over the weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.